go through a few overheads to set the context, and then we can have a discussion. So, two key points here. So if we actually have PAI the way it could play out, it would probably be much worse than the 1918 influenza attack that the U.S. had. And secondly, a concern because we are coming at this from, in our group here today, from the perspective of mental health. Mental health is not really fully integrated into the planning for PAI. So we want to kind of talk to both of those issues. So if you look at PAI projections, if it were a full-blown PAI across the U.S., the expectation based on the numbers from the Centers for Disease Control is 1% of the population of the U.S. would die and 10% of the population would become very seriously ill. So if 1% would die, the population is currently about 300 million. That would mean about 1 million people would die. In some places, the economy will literally stop. So you think about it for a minute and say, well, you know, where are you going to be going if we have PA? Are you going to go out and eat in a restaurant? Would you be in this hotel in rooms with lots of people from all over? Would you be sending your children to school? You get into all these issues that we need to think through. And one of the questions would be for any business, how many days can you operate your business with a 40% staffing, which is the assumption that CDC makes on staff, with no additional input of financial resources, assuming that system doesn't function the way it should? So can you operate your business a month, 180 days? What can you do? And then another assumption here is that this is not a one-cycle process, but it's a multi-cycle process. You have one cycle of about 15 weeks, and then you'll have a second cycle, and then you'll have a third cycle. I had a chance to see the PAI plans of the University of North Carolina. They had a very simple plan. They said, we did our analysis, and in doing our analysis, it told us we do not have the capacity to be open and withstand PAI should we be struck with this. You know, we can't deal with having 300 of our students die and 7,800 people in the hospital. Therefore, our solution is we are going to close. This happens, we're going to close the University of North Carolina and send everybody home. Well, that's one scenario. Maybe that scenario would work out. I think another part of the issue here is, can you deal with only one scenario? So I happened to be in the audience when a person presented this, so I asked them, I said, well, what if this actually begins in the Research Triangle area and the government quarantines the Research Triangle area where you can't send people home? Second question was, you're assuming one cycle here. You're going to send these people home for a semester and then they'll be back. That may very well not be true. So I think you potentially need multiple scenarios with multiple cycles. My voice is bad this afternoon. Problem will be national. External resources will not be available. So if it's a full-blown PAI, you know, it won't be like Katrina where you can bring resources in from other areas. It will be generalized. So, what has been going on here? Federal money has flowed into this problem through the Centers for Disease Control and HRSA, and that has principally happened through grants given to the states. Those grants typically are in the hands of a set of people called the Directors of Public Health Preparedness, and they have been asked to prepare PAI plans and to conduct tabletop exercises. And Priscilla will talk a little bit later about some of the issues on tabletop exercises. If you actually want to see the plans for your state, they're available at the website that is listed here. And I encourage you to go and read the plan for your own state. And those plans, Priscilla and I did an analysis of them, and we'll show you some of the results of that in a few minutes, vary from little five-page documents saying, when PAI comes, we will respond to it, to 400 and 500-page documents with high levels of complexity, and then every variability in between. In fact, one state said, when PAI comes, we're going to hold some town hall meetings on PAI. So if you think about that for a minute, you say, my God, that's ridiculous. So, yeah. And so, I'm going to lock the door here. And so, you know, there's incredible variability in these plants, exactly as you would expect there would be. And now a second factor is entering this, because the federal government is beginning to make the effort to move the responsibility of this from the federal government, moving it from CDC and HRSA and the new Assistant Secretary for Public Health Preparedness down to the states. And I think the states don't fully know this and are not fully prepared to deal with this. You know, if you think about it a little more, you'll realize the plans are critical. It isn't just we're doing a planning exercise to do it. Literally, the effectiveness of the plan you have in your state could make the difference between whether you will live or die in this process, or people in your family will live or die in this process. Therefore, we undertook an analysis of these plans. I'm going to just jump over those things. So what were some of the findings from the plans? And what Priscilla and I did, essentially, we took a sample of the plans, and we took all the big states with certainty. And we reviewed the plans, and we looked for particular things, and then we compared our outputs and came up with the list of things that you see here. So one of the key issues in the plans that we did review is that most of them don't extend beyond health, because they're funded by CDC and they're funded by HRSA. HRSA said, talk about health. They don't talk about other pieces of the infrastructure, and health is only one piece. So you could talk about the information infrastructure. You could talk about the electrical infrastructure. You could talk about the food distribution infrastructure. We could go on and on and on with all these other infrastructures that are not talked about in these plans. Impact estimates should be documented. So you get wildly varying estimates of the number of people who are going to die. From, you know, hardly anybody's going to die in our state because we have it under control, to, you know, thousands of people are going to die. And there's a standard methodology for doing this, which most states have not actually followed. Government continuity should be addressed. So one of the issues in here is the fact that although the states have plans and they do talk about continuity of state government, they don't talk about continuity of local government, nor the role of the state in assuring continuity of local government, which is, in our mind, a huge issue. Business activities are not considered in these plans. So you may need to requisition a fleet of vehicles. You may need to use the UPS vehicles in a local area to carry people, to distribute vaccine, to do any number of things. We have no inventory of those infrastructures that are out there. State plans should be coordinated with local activities. And I think in many places, if you look at a state and you look at the cities, they're doing some parallel things, but they're doing things not in consonance. Major health and social services should be included. For example, I was very amazed to find out, and none of the plans that I reviewed was mental health or substance abuse ever mentioned. So the people who wrote those plans had no idea that the mental health system probably serves about 10 million people a day across the United States, and the substance abuse system probably serves about 2 million people a day. They have an ongoing caseload, and in effect, by not including that caseload in the plan, you show that you don't know anything of the consequence of not having continuity on those services. Communication plans should be broadened. So another part of what we looked specifically at in mental health was the role of good communication plans through the media and how we communicate about this with people, because you have to make the assumption people would be very frightened to begin with, and if we do this like we do most media, the media will be hyping this up. The media will not be using useful risk communication messages about this. mortuary services should be considered. The thing that people don't address is if you actually have a very serious number of people who die, you can quickly flood beyond the capacity of the mortuary system. So if that's not part of your planning, that's a deficit. And plans should include ongoing implementation activities. Many of the plans said, you know, here's the plan. We're going to do tabletop exercises someday, and we're going to hold meetings with some people, and that's about as far as it goes. It did not go to the next level saying, okay, we have this plan. Step one calls for this. How exactly are we going to implement step one at what point in time and so on? So what did we recommend out of this? We sat down and we thought this through, and we actually convened a group of state planning directors, public health preparedness planning directors, to discuss this, and out of those discussions came the bullets that you see here. So we recommended that the government undertake a detailed review of the plans, and that has been done. We recommended that a model plan be created for people who don't know how to do plans. As far as we know, that nothing has been done on that. We recommended that a focus group of states be convened to identify barriers and solutions. We undertook that. The government did not undertake that. And we recommended that the government organize a process of providing specific technical assistance to the states. So that, you know, was, and we do in fact have a white paper on these state plans we'd be very, very happy to share. I put this overhead in because I think in the summer months this document came out. So part of this is what planning the states do and how that relates to local government and what planning local government does. But part of it is also how you as a person respond to this and prepare for it and prepare your family for it. So we're very pleased to see this document come out, which is a citizen's guide for pandemic preparation and response. And this is available at no charge, and we can get copies of this for people if they have interest in it here. Now, walking down into mental health and substance use care. So we have a second white paper that focuses specifically on mental health and substance use care. As I said before, this is not usually mentioned in the state plans at all. We argued that in our white paper that mental health and substance use care was a critical part of the state infrastructure, and that this infrastructure serves populations that will be particularly affected by the dislocations caused by avian flu. Think about the 10 million people every day who are in the mental health system, probably 7 million of which who receive psychotropic meds. So imagine that that system didn't function for 30 days or 60 days. Or similarly, on the substance use side, many of those people are on various antagonists for substance abuse. Imagine that they didn't receive those for 30 or 60 days, and you begin to see some of the consequences of this. So I pulled out a few bullets on these fields to give a sense of, you know, what we're talking about. And you all know these numbers. A non-mental health audience wouldn't know them. 6% of adults and 9 to 13% of children have serious mental illness. And if we look at the 10 million who are currently served, that 10 million only penetrates into that 6%, about 1.5%. So there's a huge number of other people out in the community with these problems who aren't served at all. Public mental health consumers die 25 years younger than other Americans. And then what we were talking about this morning, returnees from Iraq and Afghanistan are coming back with PTSD and other mental health and substance use issues. 44% of the cigarettes in the U.S. are smoked by people who have mental illnesses. 33,000 suicides a year in the U.S. 30 to 40% of teenagers are experiencing depression, and 60% of adults with substance use problems also have mental health problems. The classic comorbidity population that we all talked about. So all of these things are in play out there right now before you have a plan and before you have PAI. So we prepared a white paper This white paper is available on our website, but I'll also be very glad to get this paper for you. And the one thing we wanted to assure is that mental health and substance use services and mitigating panic are essential to reducing the severe disruptions associated with the secondary effects of PAI. So we really want to get these fields on the agenda here. What are some of the key factors? Many new cases of mental illness are likely to develop as a result of PAI. People who were not ill before will become ill. If you are the last person in your family, everybody else is dead or in the hospital, that's bound to have a major impact on you. We need to think about that. The current clients, these 10 million and 2 million, will need ongoing care. Are you going to be able to do that with a 40% staffing, which is the staffing figure CDC recommends you use? Can we staff the system sufficiently with that level of people? And then panic reactions threatening the community infrastructure. So if you don't communicate this right through the media, through CNN, you will exacerbate the problem that will exist anyway. Let's move along here. So then we thought about this and we said, again, there are several sets of actions that need to be taken here. A critical thing for the federal government is that the federal government assure the continued flow of money to the states for these services. So you've got a huge flow of money coming down to the states through the mental health block grant, the substance abuse block grant, Medicaid, Medicare. And so the federal government needs to think through the continuity of its financial operations to continue to support the services so that the services are not ended because we don't have any financial resources to sustain them or to sustain the people who provide those services. We need to plan the state and local mental health response as part of the overall planning effort. That has not been done to this date, as we are aware. We need to support the private sector response. Some companies have actually developed company-wide plans. Some of them are very good. Most don't have plans. It's a patch quilt, again, but there needs to be more done with this. And then a kind of a fourth bullet, assuring the mental health of essential personnel. The people who operate your nuclear power plants, the people who operate your telephonic systems, the people who operate your food distribution system are subject to the same kind of stresses as everybody else. Have we given a minute's thought to how we will preserve those infrastructures? I'm not trying to give you a bad day here because but I'm trying to lay out what the problem is here. So recommended actions: mitigate panic and identify and empower a lead federal agency. And there's an interesting side story to the lead federal agency. I was sitting in my office this past spring and I got a call from people I had never heard of in the Department of Labor, in the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. You know, would I come down and talk to them about PAI? So, sure. I go down and I wanted to find out before I said anything, you know, why are you working on this? And they said, you know, we went to a meeting at the White House and we said to the White House advisor on PAI, there's no plan for federal employees to respond to the mental health problems that are going to be generated by PAI. So the mental health advisor said, well, you go out and develop one. Give me a plan in 6 weeks. So it was assigned to that office and that set of people to come up with a mental health plan for the federal government. So, and they wanted me, as part of my talk, to identify a lead federal agency. Well, what I have in here, I don't mean in this that SAMHSA should be the lead federal agency. They wanted me to say NIMH should be the lead agency or SAMHSA. I said, you know, you have to think this issue through as a synthetic process of how you're going to get the key departments to work together. And that lead agency is simply your coordinative point, not the decision point. And they didn't like that answer, so I don't know what they finally put in their plan, but I really would believe that if you assign this to any of the agencies in HHS, they could not carry this out because they don't have sufficient authority. And so they did their plan, but I think that issue of, you know, who really is going to be in charge should we have this is very much on the table here. Priscilla mentioned the BioSense system. The BioSense system is a very important reporting system for these events, because if this actually begins somewhere, if the BioSense works the way it should, by the end of that very day, there should be reporting going up the system through the BioSense reporting units to CDC, to the Secretary of HHS, to the White House about what's happening. However, I think the limitation of that currently, and Priscilla can correct me, I think currently we only have inducted about 1,000 of the hospitals in this. Is that correct?
1,000 hospitals would actually include DOD and VA. And part of the challenge is there are areas that have very deep coverage. I mean, all of the hospitals in Indiana are included. And yet, none of the hospitals in Utah. So it's really based on the ability to engage your existing system and the outreach of the program, which went to states with existing systems and not major medical centers. That we're willing and interested to participate, because it's a voluntary program, it's not mandated.
I was going to ask you, because are there a number of states, or at least North Carolina now has a legal requirement in real time to report emergencies?
North Carolina is unusual, and North Carolina is reporting it through BioSense.
That is the same system now.
Well, North Carolina has their, I'm going to forget the acronym, I want to say NC Detect system that is in their emergency rooms. That reports into the state of North Carolina, which forwards the information to BioSense. Indiana is moving toward a mandatory reporting requirement for emergency room visits and for chief complaints, similar to North Carolina. But in most states, that's separate from mandatory notifiable disease reporting.
As it is in North Carolina.
Yeah, which, you know, is may or may not be timely, as I'm sure you know.
So, but again, the point of this is, if we're only covering 1,000 of hospitals, there are 5,000...
Irregularly.
There are 5,000 general hospitals, and obviously we need to, with urgency, expand this system so it covers the entire hospital system of the U.S. And I do not know whether CDC has the money to do this, but there needs to be advocacy to get the money to CDC to cover the whole system, and it should be a mandatory reporting system, not only for PAI, but for also for terrorist events. The other system I want to mention here is the VAERS system, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. When we get into this and we're giving vaccinations in huge numbers, we are very likely to have large numbers of adverse events where people have a bad batch of vaccine. The purpose of this reporting system is to report that up as quickly as possible so you can shut down a bad batch of vaccine or see why this is happening in some particular subgroup. This is run different than the BioSense. The BioSense works out of hospitals, and so it's working from micro units up and reporting upward. The VAERS reporting comes from 50 state VAERS coordinators. So if you, and somewhere in your state government, there's a VAERS coordinator who is watching this, and it comes through 6 of the drug companies. So the drug companies are monitoring this and the 50 state coordinators. So it's a very different reporting system. I put on the table why you would not take these two systems and integrate them into one reporting system. And I suspect if I went back and looked, they're coming out of different units in CDC.
They are.
Okay.
At least the units are talking together.
Okay, good. There are some recent developments on mental health in this area. The GAO has issued a report on disaster preparedness. It calls for HHS and the Department of Labor, OSHA, to assume responsibility for mental health care post-disaster. That report is available. I do have a copy of that and can get you the reference if you want a copy of it. We understand, and Priscilla told me this, and I don't know if it's come out yet, GAO is working on a second report focused on disaster behavioral health, but as far as I'm aware, it haven't seen it. I don't think it's come out yet. I think it's behind the curtain, but when it comes out, you'll be interested in it. So the question for us becomes, how can we get mental health and substance abuse care to the table? So we identified some potential actions for this. An obvious one, the state mental health agencies and substance use agencies reaching out to the state directors of public health preparedness. I think there's some urgency that happen. The state mental health agencies and substance use agencies to engage their own planners in a PAI plan process. I did happen to, at one time, receive a call from a woman from North Carolina who said she was the mental health PAI planner for North Carolina. So I asked her a lot of these other questions, and the sense I got from her was, although she was doing some of these activities, she wasn't plugged into the broader activities that were going on in North Carolina, which then kind of defeats what I think needs to happen here. And I think the state mental health agencies and substance use agencies need to work with their local facilities. So like there are 1,000 general hospitals out there, there are 5,000 mental health facilities out in communities, community mental health centers, outpatient clinics, and so on, and there are 13,000 substance abuse programs out there. And so the logical coordinative point for them is through the state agency that has oversight of their activities. And although they have oversight, I don't think that oversight has been extended to working on PAI-type issues. Mental health and substance use advocates need to work closely with the state public health affiliate. So if I went around to all my colleagues in mental health and I said, are you working with the state public health affiliate, the affiliate of the American Public Health Association, I think almost uniformly they would say no. You know, that they work in one area and I work in another. And again, that's a problem out at the advocacy level, because they need to get together and share their advocacy to help move this agenda. Mental health and substance use advocates need to educate consumers and families to the PAI threat and the recent responses. So for these 10 million people who are getting care, we really need to be having some communication with that population, not only about PAI, but about other potential disasters that could occur and how we are going to work to assure their well-being and the well-being of their family and so on. So those are some ideas we came up with on this. So that's our set of overheads. That's about as far as we've developed. What we can give you is the white paper on state plans, and we can give you the white paper on mental health, and both of those have already been published. The white paper on state plans was published in, what is that, Journal of Disaster Medicine, but we'll get you the white paper so you can have copies of it. So what we'd like to do now is to sit down with you and have a little discussion. We're a nice little informal group. It's too bad we don't have a glass of wine here to have with our discussion. And talk with you about some of the things that we might do as next steps.